Okay, and now we can pick up John. We were talking about Florida, I think, and I forget what my last question was.
Well, you simply wanted to know what I remembered about Florey, since you said that he was to be the subject of an interview such as this, but unfortunately his death precluded that.
Oh, I guess I have heard, perhaps incorrectly, that there may have been some disappointment or hard feeling that led to Florey's leaving DuPont in 1938. Did he ever intimate such to you?
No, he never did. In fact, he didn't speak very much about it at all. We wanted to know what happened, why Carruthers committed suicide, but he simply didn't say much about that. He didn't say much about why he left. When I was here, I looked up some of his early work, his letters to Carruthers, and his reports. About the only thing that I noted is that perhaps he became more involved in practical work near the end of his career and at DuPont, and this didn't particularly suit him because he wanted to continue in the fundamental work that he was aiming at and that he made such a career of, and felt that he could progress better in other organizations than he could at DuPont.
Did he ever talk about Dr. Stein or Dr. Bolter? Bolton, I guess it was.
No, never talked to Elmer Bolton.
See, I think it was in 1938 there was a change in research policy when Elmer Bolton took over at the chemical department. And
yeah. As I say, all I do is read between the lines and look at the type of work that he was engaged in, and reports that he issued, the patents that were issued to him, such as he had a patent on polymerization. And I suppose that they were channeling him into more practical work. And that simply wasn't the sort of thing he wanted to do in the long run. And these are my own presumptions.
Now, at Goodyear, then, did he have a pretty free hand?
He had a very free hand. And what he did was to formulate some new theories, and he wanted to test these out in the laboratory then. He always wanted to make his theories applicable to practical situations, so that he would do the laboratory work and make sure that the formulas weren't simply pure mathematical formulas that were rigorous but couldn't be used, so that he would have someone work on the melting points of copolymer systems to check out his melting point theory. We derived the viscosity average molecular weight relationships, and I did some work with him on that. We looked at branching and the effect of branching on viscosity and solution behavior. These are some of the publications I had with Florey. So that he was, as he always has, trying to get at the very groundwork and basic concept of any polymer theory, and trying to verify it and making his formulas applicable to real situations. But at the same time, he realized that you had to do work that could justify the fundamental work you were doing. So at the time, we were making polyester for fibers. We made the Dacron composition, polyethylene terephthalate. We also made polytetramethylene terephthalate, which just recently, of course, is a plastic, has gained acceptance in the marketplace. So we did the first work there. We had the first patents on it.
Let's see, polyethylene terephthalate is one of the low-shrink amorphous resins. Is that?
I think polybutylene terephthalate will crystallize. It's a tenite resin.
Oh, okay. Is it the GE product that's the polyester that's non-crystalline, non-crystallizable?
You mean the polycarbonates?
Polycarbonates.
Really worked on.
I was thinking
of the
I was thinking they had a polyester.
Well, the I think GE does put out the polybutylene terephthalate as well. Right.
Well,
but that's one that we worked on back at that time. We were working on it for fibers. We were working on the polyethylene terephthalate. Goodyear, of course, is a rubber company, and they were interested in new tire cords. And the difficulty is that if you make tire cords, you make them for your own tires, but you can't go out and sell them too well. And at that time, DuPont was selling fibers. Fibers were in demand, so that if you didn't buy fibers from DuPont and other suppliers, and had your own, you might find that if you needed the supply, you couldn't get it if it were on allocation.
I see. That's right.
So there's some politics in that, too.
I mean, between DuPont, the supplier, and Goodyear's, with its in-house capacity.
Right. So we worked on polyesters, but we never commercialized them. Eventually, of course, Goodyear has commercialized polyester resins for bottles.
Okay.
But that came long after Florey quit. So that we were working on it, and I think one of the reasons Florey finally left Goodyear was the fact that unless you can show some positive contributions from a profit standpoint of what you're doing in research, the research must come to an end. It's a natural consequence. So he realized this, so that he had a combination of basic research and applied research. And it worked out pretty well. And he was well thought of there, and they consulted him. In fact, he was frequently consulted at the corporate level. The chairman of the board would have him in at that time and talk to him. So he was recognized that even at that time as being a real giant among chemists.
Now, looking back to your college and graduate school career, had you been introduced to polymers at all?
Not at all.
So going to work for Florey was your first introduction, and he was your teacher?
My teacher and leader, idol, as you have it. And, you know, we thought a lot of him. We thought at the time he'd be a Nobel Prize winner sometime.
Was your work done for him mostly in synthesis? Of polymers, or?
Mostly in synthesis, right. He supplied much of the theory. But, you know, he would work it out. He would frequently ask the people working for them to check through what he had done and make comments, make corrections. And even though he had done things very well, he was not loath to accept criticism and to ask advice from people working for him. And I remember we would have weekly conferences and present our work, and other people would criticize the work, ask questions. It was a very fruitful way of conducting research. And we shared results, whereas in the rest of the laboratory, they tend to work by themselves and do things rather secretly, so that to find information, you'd have to talk to them. One of the big changes at DuPont, where they write reports and people can find out about what's going on very easily. In Goodyear, they tended to be somewhat secretive about what they were doing in different groups.
What were the other groups there then? Why were you so compartmentalized?
Well, they were working on rubber chemistry, compounding, things that were somewhat different, but even there, we did have an influence on it. They would come around with some of their problems and ask advice. And so I think that one of the contributions Florey made was to give them these vulcanized rubber heels, which were used at the introduced at that time, highly vulcanized and highly cross-linked systems, where he recommended they cross-link it to a greater extent to give it greater hardness.
And so was Florey's group a sort of a corporate research group, or pioneering group of some kind?
Well, it wasn't a big enough organization to subdivide it the way we do here. But it was the it was called the Fundamental Research Group.
How many people did that?
So I think at the highest point we had 10 people.
Any others in that group that are notable that you might recall?
Well, the other person was Tom Fox, who went on to become fairly well-known in the field. And he went with Florey when he left to go to Cornell. Harold Mighton went to DuPont and worked in the film department. Norm Rabjohn went to the University of Missouri and taught. And, see, the others I sort of lost track of.
Well, when did Florey leave Goodyear? You recall?
I think it was 48.
Okay, now during this period, the government rubber project is going on.
That's right.
Were you involved?
I was not involved with that, but we knew about it.
Was that in another group?
No.
Goodyear?
No, it was the Goodyear contingent was in another group, right, and a lot of it was centered at the University of Akron.
So
it didn't really influence us to any extent.
I guess Bert Nichols told me that Florey contributed in some way to the light scattering, at least with some of the theoretical aspects of the light scattering method, which was introduced by Peter Debye. And, but you did viscosity mostly.
Viscosity and synthetic work. And
how did you determine, get your base for developing the Mark-Hoehnke equation, determining the molecular weights by other methods?
Oh, we did it by N-group analysis to get molecular weights. We didn't have a really good light scattering.
You were working with polyesters?
Working with polyamides.
Polyamides.
So we could titrate the N groups.
I see.
So that my contribution there was to make the first synthetic branched molecules. And this work preceded the type of star molecules and eight branches. And this was the first work done by anyone synthetically in this field.
Yes, now I recall that there was, in the viscosity method, there was at least a hypothesis, not a rigorous theory, that the slope of the viscosity plot was affected by branching. Is that right?
That's right.
And this worked for polyamides, at least?
Yeah, it worked for polyamides, right. And then, of course, I worked, after Florey left, I did some work on polyelectrolyte effect polyamides and formic acid and sulfuric acid. And that was the first work on polyelectrolyte effect of polyamides.
Okay. I'll ask you a broad question, and maybe I should have asked this early on, but what do you think your most important contributions were to polymer chemistry, or either at Goodyear or later in the moment?
Well, these were a couple of things. The derivation with Florey of the viscosity average molecular weight and the branched polymers, and then and of polyelectrolyte effect with polyamides. And then later on at DuPont here, I think the most important thing I did was to work with the anisotropic melt polyesters, where I started the work at DuPont in this area.
Well, about when was that work started?
About 1972.
Okay, that's toward the tail end of your career.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And then, of course, I worked on several things along the way at DuPont.
Well, let's jump back to why you left Goodyear and came to DuPont then.
Oh, well, I left Goodyear. Well, one reason, of course, that Florey was no longer at Goodyear. And the group that we had on fundamental research just simply broke up. And and almost everyone that was associated with that group left and went elsewhere. Fox went with Fleury, and Maiden went to DuPont, and Rabjohn went to Missouri. Leitner went somewhere else, and Evans left, and I left.
Did you look at other companies as well as DuPont?
Yes, I did. It was a close struggle between GE and Schenectady and DuPont. GE had a very fine reputation at the time also. And so I finally chose DuPont, saying that this was a chemical company and there should be more opportunity for a chemist in a chemical company.
And this was in 1951?
That was 1951. And I was very favorably impressed with Hale Charch when he interviewed me at the time I went to the Goodyear. In fact, DuPont was my second choice at that time to work with Charch in the same laboratory. And so after Fleury had left, he simply contacted me again and said, "Are you interested in a job with DuPont?"
Was that right?
And so, so I went to DuPont, interviewed, and then I went to GE as well. Really, that was the only choice at the time. I didn't consider anyone else.
I see. Now, Pioneering Research Laboratory at the Experimental Station was operating at that time.
Yes, they had come down the previous fall, and I started in the spring of 51.
So who did you work for initially at DuPont then?
I started out working for Carl Black.
And he was a physical chemist.
He was a physical chemist, right.
And was your group, or what would you characterize the group responsibility?
Well, the responsibility was to develop a new fiber, either textile or industrial fiber. And at the time, we had gotten into interfacial polymerization. Morgan had pioneered this field, Morgan and Whitbecker. And so I started it began in this area, but in a very short time thereafter, they had the polyparaxylene work. And so I started work in that area looking at that pyrolysis, and I published some of the first papers in that area too. That was another research field that I worked in, and isolated various side products, and finally decided that the this method of making a fiber, although it appeared cheap, starting with paraxylene and simply pyrolyzing it and coming up with a polymer, did not give the quality fiber one needed, nor did it have the economics that would justify any sort of scale-up. And so we stopped with just doing a fundamental study of the decomposition of xylene and the polymerization of the xylene quinoid form that formed as a result of the pyrolysis reaction.
How about a brief description of Pioneering Research Laboratory as it was under Hale Charch? I recall that he reported directly to the vice president rather than through the normal textile fibers research.
No, I think he reported through the normal research organization, but he was personal friends with the, at that time, the, they didn't call them vice presidents then, they were general managers. And Andy Buchanan was that person.
Oh.
So he knew him quite well, and so that, in a way, he reported directly because they couldn't tell Charch exactly what to do. He was a very independent operator. And he justified that because he came up with a number of products, and he had a way of inspiring people to do their best work, which is, and also had a very good idea of what things could be used for. So he would start the marketing in by fostering that research that he thought would lead to products. And he had a way of inspiring people by coming around to the laboratories and talking to them, sitting down on a stool and saying, "Hey, what you doing now?" And he would give his ideas of what he thought ought to be done or what it might be useful for. And he was just a tremendous person. At that angle, and He operated independently, as you say. He shielded the research organization from the people above him so that people were a lot freer in their choice of objectives and carrying out the work. And he would take his responsibility to transfer this information above him to be solely responsible for what the laboratory did. I think nowadays they're feeding a lot of this responsibility down even to the bench chemist.
I was about to ask how much freedom did you have yourself in selecting your own projects and your own work?
Well, they encouraged everyone to select their own project, but it had to stand up against what they could give you to do, so that at any time you could say, I think that this is a better project and this is something that we should be working on. And if you could convince them that it had more potential than the project that they assign you, you could spend full time at the other project. He encouraged people to spend up to 20% of their time working on what we call bootleg projects, which would be projects that weren't related to your individual project. And at times people spent even more than that. I remember one fellow that spent a good deal of time on another project. It didn't turn out well, and finally they had to convince him that he had to stop it and do the work that would be more important from an industrial standpoint. But you were encouraged to do a lot of the work for your own ideas.
Who else did you report to then? And after Carl Black, let's say, you were in several other groups, I think, off and on, weren't you?
Yes, I was. I reported to Whitbecker. Let's see. Did we switch that off? Oh, Laura's there. So that I did report to Whitbecker for quite a while. Prior to Lanzel.
Okay.
And Lanzel was, I thought, was one of the best managers that I've reported to, because he had a way of encouraging people to do independent thinking too. He would get everyone together and say, here's a problem that we're faced with. What are your solution, pointed to each member that was attending the meeting, his group, and then he would put them all down and think about it and say, we'll select this route. But every one of us had a voice in the decision of what to do and to solve a certain problem.
Now, I see that at the time, Whitbecker and Lanzel were research supervisors.
Lanzel was a manager at the time. I was promoted after about a year to a research associate.
Uh-huh. But did you still report through a supervisor?
No, I reported through a manager after. Manager. Yeah, so Black was promoted to manager about the same time I was promoted to an associate. So I continued reporting to Black.
And then
I reported to Whitbecker when Black was promoted on. Whitbecker was a manager. And then I reported to Lanzel. I may have reported to Lanzel in between. I think I did that. I reported to Black and then Lanzel. And then Whitbecker, Campbell, Magat, and then I was
Campbell,
made a fellow.
I don't remember.
Campbell.
Todd Campbell.
Right.
I do figure.
So I worked on polyphenolactone for a while, and polyphenolactone fibers.
I remember that one. The polyphenolactone was a very interesting fiber, wasn't it? With unusual crystal structure.
Unusual crystal structure, and it had a helical structure. It also had a zigzag structure. The zigzag structure was not as stable as the helical structure. And so it also had two types of structures, alpha and beta. And the thing is, if you had it in one structure and it went over to the other, then it would induce some permanent fold wrinkling, as they say, and you simply couldn't get these wrinkles out by any sort of technique. And that's the Achilles heel of that fiber.
Yeah, I remember
fiber.
That. What, the box crease problem?
Ah, right. Box wrinkling, they called it.
Yeah, I had a little bite of the polyphenolactone work in some research picked it up and were trying to make copolymers with it. Mm-hmm. I think it was eventually the monomer is also carcinogenic or suspected carcinogenic.
That's what really killed the whole thing for good.
Yeah.
In other words, people always thought that there might be some possibility of resurrecting it. One neat thing about the polyphenolactone is that you can get very high molecular weight simply by refluxing the monomer in the cheap hydrocarbon solvent. You get over 1 million molecular weight. You filter it off so there's no viscous solution to deal with. You can then melt, spin it. And it's very stable to hydrolytically stable because of the hindered nature of the ester linkage. So it had a lot to recommend it. And it's very highly crystalline. It approximates the crystallinity of polyethylene, 80% or more crystalline.
Yep.
So it has a lot of interesting attributes.
Were you principally involved in your textile fibers and pioneering new fibers and new compositions?
New fibers and new compositions. And I worked a good deal on polyacrylonitrile, and there it was more of characterization. I worked with Bone and Statin, published a paper on it and its lateral ordered structure, and we concluded there that you simply couldn't make a polymer that was highly ordered that would have the properties, say, of the isotactic polyolefins. You can make isotactic polyacrylonitrile. It wouldn't have similar properties because the nitrile group controls the structure rather than the stereochemical configuration of the carbons along the chain. People disagreed with us at the time, I remember, but apparently it's held out because no one has succeeded in preparing a good isotactic polyacrylonitrile to this day.
I thought the only successful preparation involved the urea canal complex.
It's a question, too, of whether they achieve very much isotacticity. You know, on the alpha olefins, you might be 96-98%, but if they achieved 80 or 90%...
Oh, you're right on that. I measured it a number of times over the years.
Yeah, and you see, if you have a stretch of the same configuration, I think that you need something that's 95 or more percent stereochemically pure before you get into the high properties. It's something that goes up very quickly as asymptotically when you get up to very high configurational purity.
Well, actually, the polyacrylonitrile, Orlon, has done rather well over the years, hasn't it?
Yes, it has.
As a fiber?
So on and off, I have worked on that. And I worked in the early days of the isotactic polymers, trying to apply it to polymers with functional groups. A lot of this work was not published because we didn't publish a lot of the work that it's done.
In polyolefins or other?
No, it would be in other things, in the isotactic polystyrene, the trying to make polyacrylonitrile isotactic.